The following is a 1250 WTMA special presentation.
On the 1st of September 1939, at dawn, the Germans crossed into our territory.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
The Johnson's Wax Program with Fibber McGee and Molly.
On Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war.
How about you?
Who, me? My name is Robert Hare of Gold, eyes of blue, and muscles like Errol Flynn Hope.
President Truman has just announced that Soviet Russia has the atomic bomb.
Don't touch that dial. Listen to...
Well, hi once again, neighbors. Jack Gale, all set to go with Joe Leonard at the Honky Tonk Piano and the Firehouse 5 Plus 2, our special...
Stay tuned to WTMA!
Hear the latest on the hour about Hurricane Cleo from WTMA's Hurricane Watch.
This is Charlie Lindsay. In Swaggertown, it's 5 p.m.
When TMA news ends, TMA music begins.
And remember that all players in the R.C. Name It and Claim It contest receive a coupon good for a six-bottle carton of refreshing R.C. Cola.
WTMA. Tiger Radio.
Here are the hits that make Charleston swing on the Tiger number one.
It's WTMA bonus sweepstakes time. Another chance for you to win with number one, WTMA.
Alrighty, our prize this hour is a stereo valued at $150. Our person is...
The mighty TMA operates on an assigned frequency with 1250 kilocycles with the power of 5,000 watts during the day and 1,000 watts at night.
Hey, how about that? Going up the country, it's done by the Cat Heat on WTMA Radio. This portion of the Booby Dash Radio Showground from WTMA is being recorded and going to be sent to our armed forces around the world.
Big deal.
All right, Sam, knock it off.
WTMA.
Supreme Girls this morning on the John Fenton Show. Something rather common these days. It's called Stone Love. Sober up, you'll forget about it. WTMA time, 7:15.
That's WTMA News and what's happening Friday, August 18th. 1972.
Music. Our middle name.
It's 9:36. Also to Marcel from 1961 in Blue Moon. Good evening on you. 81 degrees, partly clear in the port city, and the Keith Nichols program with $567 in the Don't See a Low Jackpot.
TMA. It's Steve Russell. It's 7:08, and a chance for you to win $10 and a lip load of laughs and smack your mouth. Yuletide coming up.
Oh, I know it's la 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 means I love you. And no, no, no means
you keep your hands to yourself.
WTMA with Burlap.
1250 TMA at 7:53 Monday night, right here with the old Chad Bell Show. And it's nice to have you along. Going to give you a chance to win an album. Bad
as
company.
As far as I know, right now, it's TJ and Buzz.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah. 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 Freeway Scuds. CJ and Buzz.
I got some bad news for that lady.
Yeah.
What? The United States Football League.
1250 TMA, always playing the best blend of music, old and new, and on the way. In the next 20 minutes, we've got Paul Davis, also the Foundations, and Don Henley from TMA.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here we go with hour number two of the call-in portion of the Dan Moon Show.
You're with us, Rush Limbaugh and the Limbaugh Institute for Advanced Conservative Studies. We got a phone call about 20 minutes ago from our Charleston, South Carolina affiliate, WTMA, Madeline
welcome,
Kelly.
Welcome, welcome, my fellow Charlestonians, citizens of the Lowcountry, those who serve in uniform to protect the red, white, and blue, and those who serve in local uniform, sworn to protect the innocent citizens of the Lowcountry.
Thanks for tuning in to the Morning Buzz at News Talk 1250 WTMA.
Now hear this. We're the Tiger of Radio. WTMA Radio Charleston.
Hi, this is John Quincy, welcoming you to a very special program, The History of WTMA. You might not realize it, but the radio station you're listening to right now is Charleston's second oldest broadcast facility, signing on the air in the summer of 1939. The former WCSC radio at 1390 AM was Charleston's first radio station with a 1930 sign-on, but WTMA is the only AM station to still have its original call letters. In this hour, we're going to be talking to a man who was part of WTMA from nearly the beginning. Plus, we'll hear from the sons of the men who put WTMA on the air in 1939, the radio station's original owners, Wilcox Scarborough and Jesse Orvin.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Telephone Hour. Tonight, with Donald Voorhees and the Bell Telephone Orchestra, we present Lili Pons.
In the first half of 1939, electronic entertainment in Charleston was dramatically different than it is today. There were no TV stations, no computers, and no video games. The Holy City had a handful of movie theaters, but only one radio station, WCSC, at 1390 on the AM dial, which was the only radio dial as far as most people were concerned, since FM broadcasting was still in the experimental stage in the late 30s. Charleston was a one radio station town, until June 15th, 1939, and the sign-on of WTMA. Here's how the Charleston News and Courier reported it the next day.
Radio plans told by Scarborough. Exchangeites here, fellow member, proprietor of station WTMA. The letters identifying Charleston's newest radio station, WTMA, were assigned by the Federal Communications Commission and have no local meaning so far as the commission is concerned. But it is possible that station officials may advertise Charleston by employing the slogan, "Where tourists meet always or again." Why Wilcox Scarborough, one of the proprietors, said in an address at the weekly meeting of the Exchange Club yesterday afternoon. Mr. Scarborough, who with Jesse W. Orvin is owner and operator, outlined the two-year effort to bring a second station here. He explained that the most modern broadcasting equipment obtainable has been purchased and installed in a new building in Wagner Terrace, where both studio and transmitting facilities are located. The station officially was open last night when the first program was broadcast from the stage of the Dock Street Theater by remote control. Starting at 7 o'clock this morning, it will be on the air 17 hours daily. 14 persons are employed in the various departments, with each department having its own head, he said.
For the biggest sound, 4 miles around and Charleston too, to TMA.
In 1940, Franz Witte joined the still new WTMA and spent many years there in multiple roles. In 2005, we talked to Franz about his time at TMA in the station's early years.
Well, I came to work in the summer, in June, actually, of 1940. College was out, and so I went and auditioned for a part-time summer job. Bill Workman was the manager at that time. He was a former sports reporter for the newspapers, and he had been given the job of manager. So he hired me for the 6 weeks, and before it was over, he offered me a permanent job at $15 a week. And I was interested in getting married, so I accepted the job. And I worked for them until October of 1948.
All right, that was shortly after WTMA came on the air in the summer of 1940. That I don't think the station had been on the air but just about a year or so.
Yeah, the station was originally owned by the Atlantic Coast Broadcasting Company, and the Post and Courier bought them out. I don't know how long they had owned it when I went to work for them. But anyhow, they were the owners. The Post and Courier Company were the owners when I went to work for them. And they hired me as a part-time announcer and also gave me 13 accounts to write copy for. So they broke me in pretty good. Before the 6 weeks was out, they offered me this permanent job for $15 a week, and I was interested in getting married sometime thereafter, so I accepted the job and quit college.
All right, where was WTMA at the time?
WTMA, the studios were located up in Wagner Terrace, up around 14th Street, I believe. This was out in a very marshy area. There was a saltwater creek that ran from the Ashley River underneath this building that we were in. And on real high tides, sometimes you had a difficulty getting into the building without getting wet. But it was a wonderful location for recreation purposes. Some of the boys brought a BB gun out there, and occasionally you'd see a marsh hen running around. They'd try to shoot him, and then they'd put out crab lines and catch crabs, and then we got a few dozen of those. We'd have a crab crack. I'd do that usually when the network programs were on the air, and they didn't have any announcer duties except on the breaks every 30 minutes. Back in those days, NBC had two networks. They had what they called the Red Network and the Blue Network. The Blue Network eventually became ABC, but we had them both at that time.
All right, how much of WTMA's programming during the time you were there came from the network, and how much of it was generated locally? Do you remember?
It was a fight to get network programs because they didn't consider the Charleston to be in the top 100 markets. So it was mostly local during the daytime. we'd pick up a few afternoon shows. Every once in a while, we'd pick up, say, Gary Moore, who had a comedy show back in those days, and things like that. And occasionally, we'd get some soap operas, you know, like Guiding Light and all that kind of business. But basically, we had to do most of the program during the daytime. Then at nighttime, prime time, then we went on a pretty much full-time on NBC. Shortly after I went to work there, you know, World War II came up. And so we did a lot of things for the war effort. I wrote a lot of war bond sales-type programs. Then we used to interview after the war got going and they started bringing back the wounded from Europe. We'd go out to the port of embarkation and interview the returning military people. I interviewed one fellow who had been a tail gun on a B-17. When he was at approximately 25,000 feet, the tail got shot off, and he revolved in that tail, spun down to the earth, and survived. It was a rather amazing thing. Then we had a Bourbon show with Ralph Edwards, who was at a comic show and a game show on NBC. He came down to Charleston. I built all the sets that he used in the show to raise war bonds. We did a lot of things like that. After the war, the manager of the station was Mr. Robert Bradham. He'd been formerly the sales manager for the Boston Courier advertising department. He took Workman's place. Workman was a Citadel graduate and in the military reserve. And so when the war started to come, he went. He left. And Bradham took over from that point. And Bradham was a very creative sort of fellow. He was really the father of the Azalea Festival. And when that came along, well, of course, he pulled me off the job at the radio station. I spent most of my time building sets that we used in the beauty pageants and stuff like that. I'd had some experience in little theater. I'd been in about 44 plays about that time. Also built a lot of sets. And that was one of the things that we did back then. And then after the war, we built this model home over in Windermere, South Windermere, which was a relatively new subdivision. And I had to create a show to go with it. It was called Linda and Don, a young couple who were just building their first house. And then, of course, we had a mother-in-law out of the picture for some comedy. Basically, that was what I was doing. When I had been there about less than 2 years, they made me program director. And then they put me in sales also. I was in sales. I'd sell the show and then put it on the air. I had a man on a street show, for example, on the corner of Hazel and King Street or shop down there. That was the type of thing that I was involved in. Just before I left, I became promotion manager.
Which one of your jobs did you like the best?
It was all very interesting. I really liked the on-the-air work more than anything else. Because, like I say, I'd been in all these little theater productions of the Dock Street Theater and Footlight Players, and I had several leads. And so that appealed to me, the creative part of it. It was all a lot of fun. But during the war years, when I was program, I was 4F. They wouldn't take me into the Army. We had some right tough times there because trying to staff the station with announcers. We had all kind of rejects you wouldn't believe. I mean, they had nice voices and so forth, and they had nice resumes, but when you got to know them, they were all a bunch of screwballs, and you could not depend on them very much. So frequently, my work week would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 or more hours.
What kind of news department did you guys have at the time? How did you all gather
main
the news?
When we first got there, the main news we had this AP teletype. We didn't have any particular newsman, but whoever was on duty would go and strip the machine. We usually had 5-minute newscasts, didn't have any real long newscasts. And later, Mr. Bradham hired a fella, George Griswold, an older fella who could read pretty well, and made him the news editor for the station. He, of course, used that, and I don't think he really did a whole lot of creative writing on his own. After that, then, we had a girl reporter. She did that part-time. She was a copywriter most of the time, but she did go out and actually call on a police department, for example, to get news. But the news back there was not very original and not a whole lot of local stuff.
I'm surprised the newspaper didn't help you out since they owned the radio station.
Well, we clipped the newspaper. We picked up the stuff from the paper, but they set it up as a separate operation. They helped us all they could, but, I mean, it was a separate operation. We were on our own, and we did not have any reporters from the newspapers writing for us exclusively. Whoever was reading the news would read the News and Courier first thing in the morning, and he'd pick out some stories, and he'd incorporate that with what he got off the AP wire, and that would be the news for the day.
Did WTMA at that time have shows like where local musicians would come in and play?
We didn't have any local musicians just for the purpose of musical shows, but we had a lot of religious programs on the air. In contrast to the other stations, we never sold religious time. We had a fella from North Charleston that would come in, and he'd bring a few singers. That would be it. And then one time we had another fella that came in and brought some banjos and guitars. He was what we would term one of the radical religions. He didn't belong to any particular denomination. We had one of the well-known Baptist preachers out of North Charleston was on there once a week. We had the Second Presbyterian Church on once a month. I think that was about the limit to the music. It was either all church music.
Now, in the 40s, they didn't have record shows like they later had in the 50s and 60s, did they?
Yeah, they had record shows, but we didn't have the skill that they have now or the number of stuff. We were constrained by budgetary problems. We had a little girl that used to go buy records every once in a while, and if she spent $5 or $10, I mean, that was all she's going to get to spend that month. So we had this big library that was geared up that had multiple records on it. I forget what the name of the service was. And they had all kinds of music, classical, hillbilly, straight guitar music, Mexican music, symphony music, anything you could think of. But you soon ran through that stuff. After you'd been on the air for 6 months or so, I mean, you'd probably just about exhausted it.
So, for instance, there was a hole on Saturday afternoon when there was no network programming. The first type of show that you would go to would be a record show, right?
Yes, that's what we would do. We'd run whenever we didn't have any program, and that's exactly what we would do. We'd run records. We didn't have anybody that was really into the music of the day.
So the term disc jockey had not been coined during the 40s?
Yes, I think the disc jockey word had been coined, but it had not reached the stage that it did later. We didn't have any famous names in Charleston as disc jockey. That would have to come later. In that area, we were all pedestrians.
Now, what was the studio equipment like in the 40s?
It was very primitive. When we moved from the Wagner Terrace site into the Dock Street Theater.
When did that happen?
And that happened, I guess, about 1942 or 3, along about then. We only had really one studio there, and it was hot as death. They had a window air conditioning put in, and back in those days, they were pretty primitive. It was big, but it really didn't do much for the room, and then, of course, when you were on the air, you had to cut it off because it made so much noise. It got pretty uncomfortable.
This was at Wagner Terrace or the Dock Street Theater?
This is the Dock Street Theater. Actually, it was better out there at Wagner Terrace because you could open a window, and there wasn't much noise, and at least it wasn't hot and uncomfortable. Back in those days, the announcers didn't spin the record. They had a control operator, and he handled all of the recordings or played them for you. When you had a script and you announced you were going to play Blue Danube or whatever it was, and then he would play it.
Were all the commercials done live?
90% of them, because the first recorder we got after the World War was a wire recorder, which was developed in Germany. And then a little later, the tape recorders became popular or became better. If you had a commercial that wasn't done live and it was done on what you call wax, it was recorded on a disc just like a phonograph record. And most of that consisted of national advertising. We had a national representative who called on all of the advertising agents, and he was responsible for creating this business. And when he'd sign a contract with them, say for a bread company or whatever, then they'd send us this platter with all the little commercials cut in, and that's how we ran those. Sometimes we'd have live commercials, but most of that was recorded.
WTMA, would you say the station during the 40s was profitable? At that time, I know there was only one other radio station in town, WCSC.
Yeah, WCSC was our competitor. They'd been in business for a long, long time. It was an uphill struggle. I can remember some weeks when the total billings would just be a few hundred dollars. Back in those days, we were selling spots for, say, if you bought three a week, maybe you could buy them for $1.50 a piece for a week. The people that bought the most spots were the bear companies. I remember there was one company, Burger Bear, for example. I believe it was Burger. But anyhow, we tried to get this account. We never could get it. And no matter what we did, we stuck by the rate card. We didn't have any cut rate deals. At least I had none that I knew of. And we never could get this thing, and I couldn't understand it. And so I made friends with this guy, and I was in the friendly German friendly society with him. And one time, we all had a few drinks, and I said, I want to ask you something. Tell me, why can't we ever get your business? And he said, it's perfectly simple. I said, I've got a cut rate. I'm way below the rate cards, and I've got a flat $1 spot rate, and they will never raise it. Well, of course, the competition said, well, we don't cut rates. But the hell, we were cutting them left and right. We ran into all kind of deals like that. But anyhow, it was real tough going in the early 40s. If you ever hit above $500 a week, you're doing pretty good for the total sales. That was local sales, and the national sales was something else. But of course, the networks, they'd take you time, but they didn't pay you very much for the time that they were on the air. Things have changed now. So it's a whole different ballgame. But it was not easy. It really wasn't. You had to get out there and pound the pavement, whatnot. Most of the stuff that I sold, I had to produce myself. The guy said, well, I want you to do it. I had W.T. Smith, for example. He was a Buick dealer down on the corner of Church, Cumberland Street. He was just down a block from the Dock Street Theater. And I did all of his stuff for him. But I had to do it on the air. I had to make up a commercial. And then sometimes we'd get into the business where we would record some. We would use sound effects and that sort of thing. But this was at the end of my career, if not in the first.
Tell me about some of the people that you worked with at WTMA. How many people did it really take to put the radio station on?
We didn't have too many when Bill Workman was the manager. We had Douglas Bradham. He was the chief engineer. We had two others. One was Jeb Bailey. And we had another, I can't think of his name, but we had three in the engineering department. They maintained the station, and they also operated the control board. Later, we would have engineers, and then we had several control board operators. These people did nothing but run the records and put you on and off the air and put the recorded messages on and off the air. When I first went there, we had announcers. We had Kenny Dent, Vernon Bouchong, a fellow named Worthy, and then I think Meredith Smith was a female announcer, and myself. Later on, some of these people left, and we expanded that a little bit. And Mr. Bradham hired Alicia Rent, who played in Gone with the Wind. I think that was her only movie role that she played. But anyhow, they had her as a women's feature commentator. Whatnot. Then we had Julia Homer Wilson, who was another copywriter. Like Alicia, she was a fine artist, did beautiful work.
We'll continue our conversation with Franz Witte, one of WTMA's first employees, when the history of TMA continues.
You're listening to The History of TMA with John Quincy on 1250 WTMA.
The History of TMA.
Welcome back to The History of TMA. The ongoing story of Charleston's second oldest radio station. The station you're listening to right now. This hour, we're looking back at our early years as we continue our interview with Franz Witte about his 8 years spent here starting in 1940.
The tower was out in the marsh in Wagner Terrace.
So they moved to Orange Grove Road later.
That happened much later. That happened after I was gone.
Now, why did the station move from Wagner Terrace to the Dock Street Theater?
I guess the newspapers was just around the corner. And I think that they thought it was a better site, easier access for the people that worked there, and a better site for people that were coming into the station to be interviewed or to do business. One block over was Meeting Street. One block over was King Street. And it was the lower end of King up to Calhoun that where all the retail business took place. Up above that was nothing much. If you went in the other direction, over to State and East Bay Street, that was where all the wholesale business were down in that area. And then, of course, one block and you were on Broad Street, two blocks and you were at the courthouse or the four corners of the law where you had the city hall and county offices, post office on the other corner and then St. Michael's on the other. And so it really was in the center of business. Most anybody of any importance would probably have an office in that area.
Now, do they require a transmitter engineer at all times? Or was the station operated by remote control?
For a number of years, they had a transmitter operation, and I don't remember when they changed over to remote control, but I know they did have one.
Now, I've heard WTMA was just 1,000 watts at the time. Right now, the station's 5,000 watts.
We went into a hearing against a station in Savannah to get a better channel down in the low 60s.
They must have won because there's a station there at 630.
That was a frequency that we were trying, I think 630. We went all over hell and back in automobiles having these hearings in local communities and taking depositions. That was my job to organize to get the lawyer and go around and do all this. We had old man's wife, very famous Charleston family, and also a lawyer. And then I had a younger lawyer who was a friend of mine. He acted as the judge in all of the hearings. We lost out to Hobb and Daniel out of Savannah. It took a long time before we got over 1,000 watts, and I don't remember when that happened.
What about WTMA-FM? Did that come on during your time there?
Yeah, it barely came on. We had a studio around the corner when it first started in the German-Friendly Society building. Up in the top floor, we would put on the minimum broadcast required at that time. The FCC required that you put on so many hours a week or whatever. WTMA kind of backed into it. They weren't really enthused about it. They weren't going to put any money into it. They were going to let somebody else find out how good it was. And so, of course, the saturation of FM sets was very, very poor. I mean, you couldn't make any money out of that.
What about being treated as a local celebrity? Did you get a lot of that because there wasn't any TV stations on in the 40s?
Oh, yeah, man.
And only two radio stations.
Big shot. I met some people, would you believe it? I was in a restaurant here in the last year, and these two ladies came up and introduced themselves and said, "Aren't you Franz Witte?" I said, "We used to listen to you on WTMA all the time. We'd love to hear your voice." So, yeah, we got a lot of that. And anything that happened in town, the radio celebrities were usually invited because somebody wanted us to cover it. If you were a personality, you could help them. So I got invited to everything you could think of. I don't think I missed a major meeting of any kind anywhere.
Did you guys swap announcers with WCSC, or were you guys fairly competitive? And if you worked for WCSC,
very,
you stayed there for a year.
Some of the guys on WCSC, like Russ Long, for example, we'd be covering election returns. We'd go down to the core headquarters, and old Russ would give you a damn elbow in a minute to get you out the way so he could interview somebody. But it was pretty competitive. All the way down the line and in the sales, they had a salesman called Jack Hearn. I don't know if you ever heard of Jack. He was making deals constantly with everybody called on him. He'd have cigars. He'd have golf balls. He'd had anything you want Jack could get. I think what he was doing, he was giving these guys some free time for some free samples. He was a real character. But most of those people were very nice. John Rivers was a nice man. And I auditioned for WCSC before I auditioned for WTMA. It was nice. It got kind of hot sometimes. But generally speaking, we got along pretty good, you know. Old man Hall T. McGee was the general manager of the newspapers, and he was a nice fella. I remember we had a problem. Ralph McKay, who was an ex-FBI agent, came back to Charleston, quit his job, and became chief of the county police. Well, we had a real scandalous situation, and he was trying to clean it up, but they cleaned him up. They framed him up. So Ralph came to me one day, and he said, "Franz, I'd known him since we'd both been in Boy Scout camp back in the 30s. He says, "I got this problem." He said, "I understand that your station, WTMA, has a recorder." I said, "Yep, we got a wire recorder." He said, "Would it be possible for me to borrow that so I can set this guy up who's been framing me and prove he'd been framing me?" I thought about that thing. I said, "Ralph, I'd love to buy this off." I'd say yes, but I said, "I'd have to go through a whole lot of people." And he says, "Well, why don't you just go right to the top? Just bypass them all, because you don't want to get involved in all that." I said, "That's a good idea." So I went over Mr. Bradham's head, went to see Mr. Hall T. McGee. Now, he's the big manager for the whole damn Post Courier Company, and talked to him, went to see him on a Sunday. And he says, "Mr. Witte," says, "I sympathize with what you want to do. I think it's a great idea, but we can't afford to have the station involved in anything if this should be discovered. Now, he's the first place he asked me, he said, "Why did you come to me? Why didn't you go to your boss?" I said, "Because I didn't want to have too many people in on the deal. I wanted to get the final authority immediately." He said, "You did right there. I'll let you make the decision whether or not you want to lend him this equipment, but it'll be your decision. I know nothing about it. Nobody in the company knows anything about it." So I did. I lent it to Ralph McKay, and he used it over a weekend, and unfortunately, when he returned it, he says, "There was so much noise in the car, satellites couldn't really get very much. Now, if he'd had a little old tape recorder like he'd buy for $10 from Radio Shack, he could have gotten all that stuff.
Now, what did you all use the wire recorder? How was it actually used in daily or weekly use at WTMA?
Well, he used it to go out and interview people primarily.
And then when you would bring it back to the radio station, you'd hook it up to the board and play it back?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was not half as nice as the tape recorders because it was always jumping off the track or doing something like that. It was the first thing that came out was really the first recorder that anybody could use.
Now, were you all set up to record acetates at the radio station?
Yeah, record on acetate on these discs. Weren't very good, but we did. And then after you got them, it didn't last very long either. We recorded stuff for the Spiritual Society. I remember we used to come down and sing. We did special recordings for special people, not a whole lot of it sometimes. And when we wanted to send a particular program or something away from the company to a client or to our rep, then sometimes we would record it. It was very limited.
Now, looking back from your 80s at the time at WTMA, how would you describe it?
Oh, it was a wonderful experience because radio was fairly new back in those days, and I got to do everything. I got to do the whole works. I got to write the copy, got to write the shows, I got to put the shows on, be a part of them. I got to go out and sell it. I got involved in all kind of public relations activities related to shows. It was just a really wonderful time. I don't know how it is today. Then you could do anything you want. Sky was the limit. You just picked what you wanted to do and you did it.
A great big TMA thank you to Franz Witte for his time and memories. Coming up on the History of TMA, we'll talk to the sons of the men who put WTMA on the air in June of 1939. Wilcox Scarborough and Jesse Orvin.
More of the History of TMA with John Quincy is coming up right here on 1250 WTMA.
The History of TMA.
I think the people of Georgia and the South are saying that Gone with the Wind is a true picture of life in our section in the war between the states and Reconstruction days.
Yes, folks, it's another half hour of fun with Blondie and Dagwood, with Arthur Lake as Dagwood, Ann Rutherford as Blondie, and Hanley Stafford as Mr. Dither.
I recommend the election of Wendell L. Willkie as the next president of the United States.
Listen to the music of Freddie Rich and his orchestra, the songs of Connie Haynes, tonight's guests, Sally Eilers and Alan Hale, Warner Brothers star of Adventures of Mark Twain.
Washington has just announced that Lieutenant General Dwight D. Eisenhower, in personal command of that invasion army, has been made generalissimo of all Allied forces in that area.
Yes, 10,000 independent Rexall druggists at the stores with the orange and blue sign bring you the Amos and Andy Show, written by Joe Connolly and Bob Mosier.
The best for you and me when you tune to the Swingin' Three. So stay right here on the mighty TMA.
You're listening to the History of TMA. With more, here's Charleston radio historian John Quincy.
The History of TMA rolls on as we look back at the station's early years, going back to its June 1939 sign-on. WTMA's first owners were Wilcox Scarborough and Jesse Orvin. In 2005, we had the pleasure of speaking to Wilcox Scarborough Jr. How old were you when WTMA went on the air back in 1939? Do you remember?
I really think I was a senior in high school, which would have made me about 15, 16 years old. I remember my father used to pick me up from Charleston High School and take me home, and he came by one afternoon. He was waiting in his car, and I came out to get in the car, and he said, son, I want you to listen to the signal of the new radio station that we've purchased and going to put on the air. So he turned on the radio and got a signal, and he said, that's WTMA, and where tourists meet always. And so I said, well, that's fine. And
so your father really didn't say too much about the radio station until it was actually on the air testing the signal, huh?
Yes. I think what interested my father was the fact that so many insurance companies looked into radio stations and television stations. Liberty Life, for example, in Greenville, they owned a radio station, and then they owned the first TV station, and then they bought stations throughout the country. And it's a situation for a lot of insurance companies. So I think my father got the idea
from one of his friends in the insurance business, and my father was partners with Mr. Jesse Alvin. Mr. Alvin was a 50% owner in the Atlantic Coast Life Insurance Company, which insurance company that my father and Mr. Alvin started back in 1925.
So what'd you think about your father owning a radio station?
Well, my father was a fella that was always down the road ahead of everybody else. He was a fella that was always looking for opportunities, and he was very friendly, and we went to association meetings, and he knew a lot of people in the insurance business, and I'm sure that he kind of got the idea from them, and he started the radio station. He hired a fellow from the newspaper. They started off in 39, and then World War II came along, and the manager of the station, he got called into the service. He was a Citadel graduate, and he was a commissioned officer, and he got called, and that left a void in the management of the station, and it was difficult to hire people, and the newspaper came out, and they wanted to buy the station, so my father sold the station to the newspaper company.
He didn't own it very long, did he?
Well, I would think he might have owned it maybe a year or a year and a half, something like that.
Did you get a chance to go to the radio station very often?
I went there off and on. The first studio was up there north of Hampton Park, right on the edge of the marsh, and they had a radio tower up there. Seemed like the marsh was a good place to have it. And my father had several people who worked for the radio station that were friends of his. The one name that I can think of was a fellow named Ben Hutto. He was an announcer on the station. Then they had several other real announcers that announced the news, and they had the news on the hour. I remember that was something that they came out with. And I think that if the war hadn't come along and the manager of the station hadn't been called, I think my dad would have maybe tried to stay with it a little longer, but anyway.
Coming up straight ahead, we'll talk to the son of WTMA's other original owner, Jesse Orvin, as the history of TMA continues. I'm John Quincy.
The history of TMA.
Once again, John Quincy.
We continue now with our history of WTMA, Charleston's second oldest radio station. The station's original owners were Wilcox Scarborough and Jesse Orvin. In 2005, we spoke to John Orvin, the son of Jesse Orvin, about the station's beginnings.
It's a funny thing, but John Rivers, who owned WCSE at the time, hadn't made a lot of money off of radio. So he was very apprehensive about us having another radio station. Said Charleston wouldn't support two stations. Can you believe that?
WCSE had been on the air since 1930, and then
TMA come on in 39. He fought us hammer and tong with the FCC because he didn't think that two stations could be supported in Charleston, and he didn't want to go out of business.
And now there's like 30 stations in Charleston.
Right. A little aside, for example, Coca-Cola Bottling Company would not advertise in Charleston on radio at that time because they didn't need to with their image. But we put so many Pepsi-Cola commercials on the air that they changed their tune after we got established.
Now, were you actively involved in running the radio station with your father?
No, I was not actively involved. We had very capable management at that time. Edward C. Powers was the first manager, and then another one succeeded Eddie Powers, and then eventually they had Philip Bottom they hired. But it was, as they said, a good music station in the very beginning. So was most of them at the time.
What kind of business was your dad in?
It was Atlantic Coast Life Insurance Company, still in existence, and Y.W. Scarborough was one of the two equal partners, and my dad was the other one, and they put it on there. In fact, the Atlantic Coast Broadcasting Company was a corporation that name function that they used for many years after we were out of it. The newspaper, you know, eventually bought it because they said they were going to buy one of the two, and Dad and Scarborough both said, well, we can't compete with the newspaper, so they sold it to the newspaper at that time.
Now, your dad and Mr. Scarborough did not have the radio station very long, did they?
No, it was about a year or two, I think, as I recall.
And when WTMA came on the air, they were originally at 1210 on the dial, I understand.
That's correct, and there were only 250 watts at the time. At that time, the spectrum was not very crowded, and 250 watts was pretty good, better than 1,000 to 5,000 now.
Oh, and then when it moved to 1250, it became 1,000 watts.
That was an arbitrary thing that the government made them do, too. They moved everybody about 40 kilocycles during that time.
Now, what about the radio station? The first broadcast was from the Dock Street Theater, but the studios were someplace else, weren't they?
Yeah, up on 10th Avenue in the northwest section of the city, is a building still stands there where they had the first combination studio and transmitter site and business offices.
Wagner Terrace was the
place. Wagner Terrace. Mm-hmm. Then they opened a studio downtown across from the Francis Marion Hotel. There was a drugstore on the corner called Gaines Drugstore. And they opened up a studio above that drugstore. And just to give you an example, it was hot as blazes. They put 100-pound blocks of ice in the window and put exhaust fans light and blew across the ice to give them air conditioning where they could keep it quiet.
Now, did they actually broadcast from the studio on a regular basis there, or that was just for special occasions?
Yeah, that was
occasions?
A regular studio because they figured they had to compete with WCSC up on top of the Francis Marion Hotel.
What kind of programming did WTMA have when it first came on the air?
It came on the air as an NBC affiliate, for one thing, and they used news and music and Man on the Street program, and, well, WCSC did the same thing. Russell Long was their first man on the street.
That was WTMA on the air 24 hours a day then?
No, sir. All of them pretty well signed off during that time, around 11 or 12 o'clock at night. They assumed that there was no audience after that.
Now, how long was it from the time that your dad and his partner wanted to put a radio station on the air? How long did it take for them to actually get WTMA on the air?
Oh, I would say close to a year, because there was a fight with John Rivers before FCC and what have you. And, of course, they fought him and won the point. In fact, they got into a testy little argument about after they got the channel, because they had agreement with CBS that they would go on with CBS. And John Rivers, of course, got upset about that. He thought maybe we knew something he didn't, so he got involved in it, got some friends in New York to undermine us, and he took over CBS, and, of course, TMA went on with NBC.
So you say that your dad and his partner decided to get out of the radio business because they knew that the newspaper wanted to buy either WCSC or...
They were going to buy one or the other.
Okay.
So they figured that their prime occupation was the life insurance business, and it was. So they got out of it.
Did they make any money operating the radio station, or did they make their money when they sold it?
They didn't make a lot because they were trying to build a station up. They subsidized it from the insurance company for a while, and that was where it got started. But it finally broke ground and started selling commercials properly. They had a pretty good sales staff at that time.
How do you think Charleston felt about having a second radio station back in 1939?
It was well received. Some of the commercial advertisers that we got said, well, they were glad to get some diversification because the CSC was not too anxious to handle some of the smaller accounts.
So competition was a good thing, huh?
There's no doubt about it. Both of them benefited. I don't think John Rivers ever made any real money until the second station went on the air.
Can you tell us what the station was like when it was at Wagner Terrace and then when it moved to the downtown studios?
At Wagner Terrace, they had the studios and transmitter there, but the studio wasn't very big, and they had a little cubicle, too, that they could just, maybe a news reporter would work from. And it was a combination building, and it sat out over a little tidal creek off of 10th Avenue, and it had a self-supporting tower up there in that location, but they decided they needed the better image downtown, so that's when they went to the studio, and they built a studio over the drugstore, Gaines Drugstore downtown. Had a nice studio down there, too. Had a large studio and a small studio and a small business office in there, too.
But they still operated with some offices at Wagner Terrace, too?
Yes, more or less the management offices was in the Wagner Terrace, but then they later moved the general manager down there. And I later went into broadcast myself because of my indoctrination of it.
Oh, really? What'd you do?
I built a radio station up in the tobacco area. I bought a little Bennettsville radio station and put on the first AM station. It was a 10,000-watt station, WBSC. It was actually located at Bennettsville, South Carolina, small.
Mm-hmm.
But it covered the entire tobacco markets, and we built it as a Tobaccoland USA.
And what year was this?
Oh, that was 1949 through the time the television come in. I finally got rid of it because the television market was killing us. But then I was in other businesses. several other businesses, and my experience was that I probably should have stayed with it until they weathered the storm of the onslaught of television, but I didn't. I got into different things. I was in a number of different businesses.
Well, radio changed, and even though TV was supposed to kill it, it has continued to survive and by doing different things, and radio stations still make a lot of money today.
Well, they took a lesson, too, from the record industry at the time. They thought with the records, when once a radio station went on air, they wouldn't be able to sell records. Well, it boomed instead.
Coming up in our next hour of the history of TMA, we'll move ahead to the 50s and talk to the legendary Jack Gill. If you'd like to find out more about WTMA's rich heritage, go to this website, WTMAmemories.com. There you'll find more interviews, plus recordings of past broadcasts, photos, and more. That's WTMAmemories.com. And keep it right here as WTMA continues to make and report history. This is John Quincy.